My name is Dario Hasenstab. I have 2 degrees in international affairs, and I'm here with Balder Hagrads, a former university professor of mine, as well as an IR consultant. And together, we're bursting the Western bubble. Today, we will analyze Israel's increasing isolation in the West through the lens of the Western bubble, because while Western societies have many strengths and significant weaknesses, in order to analyze these, we use the concept of the Western bubble. If you would like to know more about this concept, how this podcast started, or who we are, make sure to listen to our introduction episode. Hi, Balder. Why are we talking about this topic today? Why are we talking about Israel and Palestine again?
Hello, Dario. Well, here we are 6 months later, roughly, and one of the advantages of time is that it allows us to observe patterns that maybe in the heat of the moment are harder to see, right? And I don't think in this episode we're going to say things that are completely different from issues that we've discussed in the past, but you can notice that the violence that has been taking place has not produced the outputs that Israel would like and has created enormous destruction to the Palestinian people and also to Israeli foreign policy. So it's a good moment to analyze that.
And what are the facts?
An armed conflict between Israel and Hamas-led Palestinian militant groups has been taking place chiefly in and around the Gaza Strip since the 7th of October 2023, when Hamas launched a surprise attack on southern Israel from the Gaza Strip, killing 1,139. After clearing Hamas militants from its territory, the Israeli military embarked on an extensive aerial bombardment of the Gaza Strip, followed by a large-scale ground invasion beginning on the 27th of October. Clashes have also occurred in the Israeli-occupied West Bank and with Hezbollah along the Israel-Lebanon border, the fifth major escalation of violence of the Gaza-Israel conflict since 2008, is part of a broader Israeli-Palestinian conflict and the most significant military escalation in the region since the Yom Kippur War 50 years earlier. Since the start of the Israeli operation, more than 30,000 Palestinians in Gaza have been killed, including over 12,300 children and 8,400 women.
What is the bubble?
Again, as a bit of a disclaimer at the beginning of this episode, we've done this for the past episodes, right? We are not picking any sides. We don't want people to die on either side. We are appalled by the anti-Semitism that occurred immediately after the attacks. We are appalled by kind of Israel's overreaction, full-on invading the Gaza Strip. It's very sad, like, times to live in, right? The last 6 months weren't the nicest ones.
No, they certainly weren't, and you can see that this has had major impacts on people all around the world. So there's something, of course, about this long-lasting conflict and violence that goes back all the way to the 1940s that triggers emotions and a response that's very, very, very severe globally. And in many ways, I don't think it is relevant for us to have to identify who we're with or who we're against. I mean, just observing that 30,000 Palestinians have died is a tragedy, and we can wag our finger and say, oh, Netanyahu, you monster, but I don't think that actually has any analytical value to our listeners. What we need to do is try to understand these patterns, right?
And most importantly, and the aim of this podcast, is to understand the Western patterns that are maybe aiding or facilitating behavior on either side, right? And for this case, particularly the Israeli side, because, and this is something that we've analyzed in the past episodes that we've recorded on this topic, and I do think it's a nice observation of time to maybe go back and listen to them from a listener's perspective, because we recorded one very quickly after the attacks, and then one on January 31st, right, after the ICJ's ruling on Israel. And you can kind of see the development of the conflict and also the development in our analysis of the West here. But there's one thing that we basically pointed out since a few months ago already, is that there's a Western habit of following Israel's claims on, oh, X amount of people were killed, or, you know, the United Nations agency in Gaza, you know, they're evil, and there were Hamas terrorists involved in it, or they have too close to ties to Hamas. You know, the countless claims have been made by Israel in the past, which were not necessarily backed up by the most evidence, but the West very quickly believed them and then afterwards had to backtrack and regret it.
Yes, and this is a common pattern. For anyone who understood anything about the situation, it was clear in the week after the 7th of October that Israel, the Netanyahu government in particular, was going to go very aggressively, very violently into Palestinian territories, and that that would be bad news for an awful lot of innocent civilians who would face sort of the wrath of Israel there. And yet the West decided for weeks or months to be blind to that. They decided to, you know, be hiding behind those standard phrases like Israel as a democracy has a right to defend itself, etc., etc. They opened the door by actually just backing Israel and believing claims that were made by Israel over and over again. Even specific claims, right? Even the claims of, here are 40 babies that are beheaded, and then Joe Biden putting that out there at a press conference afterwards turned out to be completely incorrect. The West has this tendency to just follow Israel and then ask difficult questions later. And the problem with that is that the West then becomes responsible, becomes a party for the enormous destruction taking place. This, by the way, could also be said about the decades of settlement policy and those kinds of dynamics that can be analyzed, right? Automatically, the West defends Israeli policy, and only when it becomes completely obvious that things have gone awry do they start scratching their heads.
And this, well, so this works for Israel in the short term. Right. I mean, in the short term, actions by Israel are excused, maybe facilitated in that sense. And this is a very comfortable position for Israel in the short term. However, when we're talking about the long term, we're seeing a completely different image where, I mean, obviously, Israel's reputation has tanked globally, but particularly in the region in the last 6 months.
And the West starts noticing that it's actually harming their own global interest, right? So if the West still believes itself to be some kind of shining light on the hill for others to follow, which is, we've discussed over and over again, is a questionable position to have, but there are certain elements in Western foreign policy that still believe that it's the role of Western Europe and the United States and Canada to take the world into a more utopia direction somehow, then what happened here with Israel is terrible, terrible news for them, because they actually, their association with Israel, their defense of Israel, their support for extreme violence committed by the IDF actually hurts their image globally. It hurts their image even at home. People are starting to question, government, what are you doing? Why is my country partially responsible for the violence taking place? Why can't your country, why can't the Netherlands or the UK or the United States vote in favor of a ceasefire? What is going on here? So it has very significant domestic and foreign policy consequences. And that means that more and more the West will become hesitant to support Israel and to take their word for things. You know, you can only exaggerate or even lie X amount of times before people just don't follow you anymore.
Absolutely. And I mean, so you mentioned the ceasefire, right? So calling for it in the United Nations Security Council, everyone voting in favor except the United States. And then people ask themselves, why? I mean, there's a clear, right, asymmetrical warfare going on. There's a big, powerful army fighting against, well, an armed group in a guerrilla style. And then around that, you have a lot of people dying. I've read it out, 30,000 in the last 6 months. You have a lot of just extreme poverty, right? Because there's no food getting into Gaza. Israel has completely blocked it off. We saw this with the United Nations, that more and more Western countries suddenly started to vote in favor of ceasefire resolutions, except the United States. And now we're seeing the same with food deliveries, or with basically dropping aid from the sky, or maritime operations, where initially it was Jordan, right, and the immediate neighbors of Israel and Gaza that kind of supported the population. And now six months in, that's very late, right? I feel like that question could have come up earlier. 6 months in, the West is realizing, oh, maybe we should send some aid too, right? So it's these types of things where you immediately have the West usually reacting pro-Israel, then seeing that this isn't necessarily working out, it's causing bigger humanitarian suffering, and then backtracking a little bit and going with the rest of the world, isolating itself, but also Israel further on the global stage.
And this goes exactly back to that very deep fundamental aspect of the Western bubble, namely an inherent belief in democracy, right? An inherent belief that democracy will always produce, or typically produce, positive, constructive outcomes. And the early narratives of, hey, as a democracy, Israel can, of course, defend itself against the evil terrorists, as if you can simplistically put it like that, right? That's terrorism versus democracy. The evil terrorists need to be defeated by this shining democracy called Israel, and we trust them because they are a democracy, is, of course, a very deeply ingrained aspect of our bubble thinking, that somehow democracies have this peaceful nature to them. Now, what is a much more interesting and much more important kind of distinction is what you refer to with respect to a state versus a badly defined group. Because people can say, okay, we can define Hamas, sure, but who belongs to Hamas and who sympathizes with Hamas? And if you sympathize with Hamas, are you part of Hamas? That is not well defined at all. That is very ambiguous, very gray, as all these non-governmental groups are. And now you see that on paper, you've got an incredibly powerful, clearly defined state, Israel, fighting this badly defined group, and you notice the impotence of that state, that despite its overwhelming military power, it is not achieving its goals.
Interesting that you say achieving its goals, because my question would be, what are the goals? I haven't necessarily heard that yet, right? So the goal would be to rid Gaza of Hamas, but then, as you just mentioned, who is part of Hamas? Is it everyone who holds a gun? Is it everyone who holds sympathy for Hamas? Is it everyone who has aided Hamas in the past or worked together with Hamas? Who is that, right? What splinter groups are associated to it, what not? Is it basically taking over Gaza and administering everything? What's the goal here? And that's one of those things, right, where we haven't necessarily heard what the goal is from Israel. Nor has the West, right? And we as the population within the West, I haven't heard a goal formulated by the German government. I mean, I'm not expecting that, because the German government is not very good with strategic goals. But at the very least, I should hear, well, our goal is to have a ceasefire there tomorrow, because, and then between party A, party B, and then in the long term, we want a peace scenario, which has yet to be defined, be developed. But no, we're not hearing anything of this in the West. The only thing we're hearing is kill all the Hamas fighters.
Yeah, so the first golden rule of any foreign policy making, well, policy making in general, I would argue, but in my area, foreign policy, is you have to ask yourself, what does success look like? When are you happy with the outcome? When you can you say, we're done? And this was exactly the problem during the war on terror, that nobody knew what success looked like, for exactly the same reason, right? You can find Osama bin Laden, but does that mean you're done? Well, apparently not, because you keep on fighting and fighting. And who are you actually fighting, and with what goal in mind? Killing Hamas is an empty statement. You can kill 10,000 Hamas warriors and there will be another 5,000 waiting, and you can kill those 5,000 and there will be another 5,000. Objective, which is not objective at all, is defend yourself. What does that mean, defending yourself? Is, if you put that in terms of security, like defend yourself in terms of making Israel secure, I don't think anyone can claim that now, 6 months down the line, Israel is more secure in its global position or in its domestic position than before the 7th of October. Not at all. There are more people wanting to do damage to Israel. There are more governments who are less likely to support Israel. Israel is less secure, less safe because of its own action. So that's the problem. You start in an emotional state of mind, start an incredibly destructive, violent campaign without actually knowing what you really want to achieve. Now, the other specific goal, I guess, that you sometimes hear is get the hostages back. Well, that hasn't been exactly a success, has it?
Not at all. But I mean, I think you just said something very interesting, right, with regards to Israel's security. I mean, so let's focus first on Israel's domestic security. And then in the next category, we can, right in the IR perspective, we can talk about the international one. Domestically, yes, I would say there's now fewer missiles or rockets aimed at Israel than before. So that could be defined as a success, yes. But at the same time, within Israel, you have now a lot of Palestinians or Arabs that feel antagonized, to say the least, by the government. In the West Bank, it even worse, right? Because you have a lot more people who have now been living a lot worse lives for the last 6 months. And within Gaza, I don't think we need to even begin that discussion. So domestically, it doesn't seem to be going very well for Israel when it comes to its own security.
Yeah, and even that tiny little victory that you mentioned at the beginning, fewer missiles or rockets, that is because the groups that usually do those kind of things are a little bit busy at the moment. But you can count on the fact that once things calm down a little bit in Gaza and elsewhere, then the rockets will start flying again. These groups are not deterred now to... They're not thinking, oh, now we better not do this in the future anymore. They will absolutely up, you know, they will absolutely increase the number of attacks in the future based on the events from the past 6 months.
What's the international relations context?
Well, that was it with regards to the domestic position. Let's talk about the international position, or the regional position, to be exact. In the past 20 years, we've seen a bit of a realignment within the Middle East, right? So you kind of saw the enemy status shifting a little bit, right? Before, Israel was obviously enemy number one. That has changed. I would say it was a lot more of a constructive approach within the region towards, well, maybe through collaboration, we can actually all achieve better for each other. And let's be honest, we don't like Iran at the moment because of its actions in the region. So you had a bit of a realignment, right? So you had these normalization processes in 2020 between Israel, the UAE, Bahrain, Sudan, Morocco. You always had talks of Saudi Arabia, right, finally normalizing relations with Israel. That's obviously off the table now. And if anything, all the neighbors are now looking more negatively at Israel again and less likely to increase its security by normalizing relations and having good relations with each other.
And in those cases that they will probably pick up the phone again, like Saudi Arabia, at some points, they will have to do so much more carefully not to have a backlash from their own domestic populations, right? So Riyadh clearly wants to, at some point in the foreseeable future, get back to negotiations because they are interested in normalizing relations with Israel. But it's going to be much harder to sell that to the Saudi population right now. And it's going to make it much harder to sell it to the broader Arab population. And Saudi Arabia is very sensitive to how it is perceived by the Arab world. So essentially, even those governments that will at some point go back to the negotiating table will find it harder to do so. And that is made even worse by the fact that these problems go beyond the region. China and Russia and Sub-Saharan Africa, South Africa, to name one, are now much more antagonistic towards Israel's position in the world, which is terrible news if you're Israel, because the whole reason why they tried these normalization processes in the first place was because they understand that the next 50, 100 years are going to change the position of the West, and they might not be able to rely on the West to protect its territorial integrity. And therefore, they needed to create these new ties with other types of actors, and they've completely burnt all their hard work from the past 20 years as a result.
And it is also terrible news for the Western bubble, because the only basically big actor on the world stage now left to be with Israel is the West. So Israel is pushed back into the arms of the West in that sense, which further reinforces the bubble, right? Oh, we're the only ones who can protect Israel on the global stage. Everyone is against them. So we will have to do everything in our power to be with them. And which also decreases the likelihood of criticizing Israel, right? And saying, hey, maybe these the current actions are not a great idea. Maybe they're hurting your security situation. And right, to never forget this when we're talking about these international relations terms, right, of hurting your security, we're also looking at 30,000 people who have died in the conflict in the last 6 months.
Yes, and this is something that I've noticed even with students at university that come from other parts of the world. They sometimes find it very difficult, and understandably so, to understand why countries like the Netherlands, let's leave Germany out of this for a second, the Netherlands or the UK or even France and certainly the United States, why they have such a, if you like, blind spot for Israel, right? That is very difficult if you didn't grow up in a society that is very concerned, and rightfully so, about anti-Semitism, is still deeply aware of what happened in the 20th century, etc., etc. That is one of the reasons why the Western bubble is, you know, not always completely without justification, but it is very deep and very strong, this bubble thinking when it comes to Israel. And the result of that bubble thinking is that there is a huge disconnect between global, universal, popular opinion, public opinion, and Western public opinion. And the West can not claim to be this leader of global morality, this leader of global affairs, if public opinion in Africa, in Latin America, in Asia, goes against it. And this is a very clear expose, very clear case in which the West is shown to be isolated in its perspective from the rest of the world's public opinion.
Absolutely. There's a, I would say, globally perceived moral deficit of Western action. Right? So the basically pole within international relations that has always claimed human rights, right, international morality, wagging its finger at others, right, all these things that we've mentioned in the past, they are now looked at by the world. We see, who are you wagging your finger at? You should be wagging it at yourself, because how are you justifying the actions of this one player right now if you look at the 30,000 people who have died on the other side?
And of course, this has been a consistent problem for the Western bubble for decades, not just relating to Israel, but also the rest of the world looking at the destruction in Iraq, the destruction in Afghanistan, destruction elsewhere, and saying, West, you're disconnected from my understanding of morality. I find it immoral when I see civilians die, and you are supporting or directly responsible for the death of civilians. You can package that in any way you like about democracy and fighting dictators or fighting terrorists, but I just see people dying because of your foreign policy, because of your military action, and I cannot relate to that. I cannot morally connect to that. And the West doesn't understand that their self-perception of doing these things, you know, out of tough love, if you like, having to be strict with the rest of the world, but in the end, making the world a better place, is not understood, not recognized, and not accepted by the rest of the world.
Another element that comes into this, and we briefly mentioned this in the bubble, is, right, Israel is this big military power, and on the other side, you have this armed group, Hamas, right? So asymmetrical warfare, not your traditional type of war in that sense. That's also the reason why we haven't called it a war in this episode and will not, right? It's an armed conflict between an army on the one hand, a very powerful army. I mean, one of the best equipped in the world, one of the ones that trains the most. And on the other side, you have basically Hamas fighters who also train probably most of their life, but are not as good as equipped. And we see something that we've observed in many other conflicts as well, is that that doesn't mean anything for the reality on the ground.
And that is especially because of the ambiguous nature that we referenced before of an organization like Hamas. If they had actually 10,000 soldiers that could be easily identified and that's it, then it might be a little bit simpler. But most people who belong to Hamas are actually not fighters, right? Most of them are people who work in social services, people who are politicians or who work in humanitarian projects, etc., etc., which creates this enormous complexity for Israel to actually identify and fight, just like the United States couldn't clearly identify the Taliban in Afghanistan. Just like they couldn't identify the exact enemy of ISIS or groups within Iraq after the invasion of Iraq. And that leads to a very important conclusion, that in international relations nowadays, having a omnipotent or seemingly omnipotent military, an all-powerful military, is very limited in scope and doesn't actually provide you the power that you think it does. It does guarantee territorial integrity. Iran cannot invade Israel. That's just, that wouldn't work. But it doesn't actually help you to organize the world in the image that you want to see. It doesn't actually help you achieve your security objectives. In order to do that, in the complexity of 21st century, you have to look at non-military methods. And that is something that I think countries like Israel, but also the United States and the West in general, are late in realizing and are not catching up with quickly enough. That in order to have actual power to influence the world in the way that you want to influence it, your military is most of the time useless.
And can you explain to our listeners what is the problem?
This is also mirrored, I would say, in the damage, because one of the very clearly defined goals that Israel had with its operation in Gaza was to free all the hostages. Right, that was clear. I mean, so Hamas on the 7th of October took, I think, was somewhere between 250 and 300 hostages. Right, so civilians, soldiers, women, the elderly, children, and so on and so forth. Right, people who lived through extreme trauma, and then Israel said, okay, we will get all of them back. That's basically our goal here. And that was one of the things where I said, okay, this is a goal that I can get behind. Let's talk about tactics, right? And then we in one of our episodes said, well, I mean, the easiest way is not necessarily dropping bombs all over Gaza, because you might hit your own hostages. But maybe diplomacy might be a good way, right? I mean, there will be something out of the will be coming something out of this, and that's exactly what we saw, right? We saw these there was a break of violence for 2 weeks, right? During which hostages were exchanged from Gaza into Israel, and then prisoners from Israel into Gaza, and that's how the majority of the hostages were freed. But kind of going back to what you just said, what you said just now, right? With the big army going then in, the sad observation here is that the Israeli military has saved 2 hostages in the last 6 months, right? Where they actually kind of grabbed them from within the Gaza Strip and took them out. But they have directly shot 3, right? So they kind of, like, these hostages kind of freed themselves, they got out, and the Israeli military mistook them for Hamas fighters and shot 3 of the hostages. The rest was freed by diplomacy, right? What you specifically said is that there are other tools which are extremely or significantly stronger on the international sphere, which you should strengthen, but which aren't strengthened in this case. But what you're achieving on the other end is something extremely sad and predictable as well, is that 30,000 people have died, 2.2 million people in Gaza are starving, and 70% of the houses in Gaza have been destroyed.
Yeah, and that in itself, those statistics that you just mentioned, those numbers, those horrifying numbers, 30,000 people having died, you don't have to get into any analysis about morale, about who is right and who is wrong, about the origin of these events. You don't have to identify as pro-Palestinian or pro-Israeli. You can just say 30,000 people have died, 2.2 million starving. I'm repeating your statistics here. Enormous destruction in Gaza. And what has it actually accomplished for Israel? Just for Israel. Nothing of significance, but it has caused a lot of extra problems for Israel. It has weakened Israel on the world stage. Very, very damaging 6 months for Israel. And they've created this damage to themselves by killing 30,000 people. I don't see any way that you can get out of this observation. And you do not have to agree on ideology. You do not have to agree on who's right or wrong. This observation just stands by itself. Pointless 30,000 people died without anything to show for it.
Well, the worst thing here is that this was predictable, right? I mean, and so I remember having these conversations in the immediate aftermath of the 7th of October. Right. And you always have these hawks in international relations who say, well, we just have to invade there. Right. I want to see a large scale military invasion going from house to house, knocking on each door and killing every single Hamas fighter. Right. I mean, that's always this. I don't know how people still have this idea that this might work. Right. We've seen that it doesn't work, particularly in Iraq. But people kind of claim this. And then you would sit down in a conversation with them, right? And I did this a few times. And you would say, well, basically, then what's going to happen is you're going to have a lot of civilian casualties. A lot of the Israeli military is going to die. You're wasting a lot of resources. And you basically will not accomplish anything because in a guerrilla war tactic, you're not achieving anything. This was so predictable. I'm sorry. I say it at the beginning of each episode. I have 2 degrees in international affairs. If I can say that, and many other people have said that, then how can we live in a world where Western military advisors and Western military politicians and politicians within Israel cannot see this and cannot predict that?
Yeah, so we said that in the first week after the 7th of October, we discussed this. The dirty little secret behind the answer to your question, how is it possible that Israel and Western advisors, military advisors don't see it, is that they do not behave like rational actors. They are not rational agents. The dirty little secret is that in many ways, what Israel has been doing over the past 6 months has been a act of anger, of aggression, because of the pain inflicted on the 7th of October. It has been Israel wanting to strike back, not because it would lead to anything productive, but needing to get rid of this pain and suffering that they faced in that weekend in October. Very similar to what the United States did after 9/11. 3,000 people died in the United States. They needed to get rid of this emotional state. They needed to have events, a place to direct it at. And that's exactly what the United States did. And that's exactly what Israel did. Without any rational analysis at the core of that act.
And then to answer my own question, why did the Western politicians and Western military advisors not do this? Well, the answer here is the Western bubble, right? Is that Israel is a democracy. We kind of have a soft spot for Israel. We always want to, because, right, it was attacked. We see it as our duty. And hey, I, as a German, very much see it as my duty to protect Israel. And we kind of failed to protect Israel. So now we'll support Israel in any way, shape or form to kind of achieve this goal of protecting Israel, right? So I mean, yes, unfortunately, right, if you kind of rationalize the irrational human behavior, you kind of come to these conclusions. But we still have 30,000 people dead.
But absolutely, but it wasn't, I would argue it's a little bit more than that. It was also the West simply feeling attacked themselves because of their identification with Israel and with the fact that we straight away got all the details about the hostages and all the details about the people who had died in the attacks. We humanize Israelis because they are one of us in our bubble, and we dehumanize Palestinians because we know very little about them. We have no emotional connection to them. So when this happened on the 7th of October, we also felt a little bit attacked. And we identified with them, oh, evil terrorism, Israel, you brilliant, beautiful democracy. Of course we have your back. Of course you should start fighting back. Because we weren't rational agents in the West either. We were emotional. And we had a stake in this violence.
Right, and the very same can be said about people who sympathize more with the Palestinians, so within the Arab world, also within like Arab communities within the West, right? So you probably saw they probably saw fewer images of the hostages and of the people killed in Israel, but then a week later, immediately saw the aerial bombings in Gaza, and getting all these videos and images out of Gaza of children dying, hospitals collapsing, buildings collapsing, people starving, and so on and so forth. And therefore, having a closer emotional connection to the Palestinians than to the other side, right? It's rationalizing irrational human behavior is, I assume, is good for policymaking, but it's also really sad.
I would love to know if there was someone, and there might have been cases, right? So if anyone is aware of that, any listener is aware of that, please send it to us. I'd love to see it. If anyone who, let's say on the 11th or the 12th of October, put out images or pictures of the violence committed by Israel and the death and destruction caused by Israel, if they, on the 7th or the 8th of October, also put out pictures and videos of the death and destruction caused by Hamas, right? And typically that doesn't happen. If you start identifying with one group, you don't really care that much about the other group. And that doesn't mean that you are happy that people die, but I would guess that 95 or 99% of the people who were outraged, understandably so, by the violence committed by Israel, weren't outraged particularly by the violence committed by Hamas.
And what now?
So what do we do now? I mean, well, so we just called for more empathy, right? So for more rationalizing irrational human behavior in that sense. We see a bit of a change within Western policy, right? We discussed this at the very beginning, that after kind of blindly following Israel in the beginning, the West always has to backtrack a little bit. And we see this particularly in the United States with regards to the upcoming election. So you see that Biden is under a lot of pressure within his own party from the left in his own party. So that is changing a little bit the behavior. I also think that these images now coming out of Gaza will have an effect within Western populations, kind of saying, well, I mean, I don't want 2.2 million people to die, of which half of them are children. I don't think many people can get behind that. So we see that at least changing to a certain extent.
Yes, and it's not just politics. Politics is part of it, right? But it's also the fact that, I would say almost surprisingly, US politicians and West European politicians are shocked by the actual outcome of Israeli actions, right? They genuinely supported Israel, saying, hey, do what you do. And now 6 months later, they look at it and they say, oh, that's not exactly what I thought would happen, which shows a lot about their irrational position early on. And now they have to go through these very difficult mental gymnastics of rationalizing their own choices in the past, and at the same time understanding that they can't continue with those kinds of choices, and they have to change their tone towards Israel if they want to be able to sleep at night. Because no, you know, there might be some psychos around, but no normal Western European politician sleeps well at night knowing that they have contributed to the deaths of 30,000 people, 15,000 of which are children. Your average Dutch or German or French politician doesn't feel comfortable about that. And now they have to rationalize that, they have to deal with that, and they at least want to make sure that in the next 6 months there's not going to be a similar amount of violence coming from the IDF.
Hopefully. And then we see, let's look at Israel here, right? So Israel invested heavily in making friends in the last 20 years. That all got basically ruined within the last 6 months. And now it's going to, once this violence maybe stops at some point, it needs to invest a lot more than before to kind of get back to the point where it was 6 months ago.
Yeah, so we are living in a world that is very rapidly changing for everyone. Israel understood this in the 21st century. They understood that they needed to start hatching their bets, that they had to start preparing for a world where the United States and Europe were no longer all-powerful. Now they've taken enormously backwards, and they have broken a lot of their hard work over the past 20 years, diplomatically, geopolitically, etc., etc. And they're going to face a very difficult few years in which they have to regain some kind of normalization, normalcy with respect to their relations with China, with Russia, with Africa. And whether that's possible or not, we'll see. But it's going to require a lot of hard work. And if I were an Israeli, I would be very concerned about this. And I would ask very tough questions from my government. What have you done to our future? What have you done to our position in global politics?
This seems like a great moment to end today's conversation on Israel's increasing isolation in the West. If you have any questions, comments, or regards, make sure to send us an email to thewesternbubble@gmail.com, and we will try to incorporate them in our following episodes. Thank you very much to the listeners for joining us today. Make sure to join us again next week when we burst the Western bubble. That is it from my side, Balder. Which closing quote did you pick for us today?
I've got a quote from the great philosopher Bertrand Russell, who said, Collective fear stimulates herd instinct and tends to produce ferocity towards those who are not regarded as members of the herd.